Good morning.
Good morning, Carolinas.
You are tuned in to the Saturday Splash here on 94.5 WGTK The Answer. We are Maddie and Lynn and guest Patricia.
Hi.
We're from the Greenville County Soil and Water Conservation District here in beautiful Greenville, South Carolina. And Patricia Whitener is our Greenville County 4-H Extension Agent.
Go Tigers.
Woo. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Ooh, it is Saturday. Go Tigers. Go Tigers every day, even though football's over now. Go Tigers.
Go Tigers. Yeah. You know, we like football.
Yeah, we like football and we like the environment here on the Saturday Splash. Good segue. Today, we're going to talk about the environment today.
Really?
Would you be surprised?
I would not be surprised. You, Patricia?
Well, it's been around a long time.
A very, very long time. This is true. But, you know, we haven't always been protecting it. So we're going to dive into a little environmental policy today and talk about some of the major environmental policies that have shaped modern policy and that have really helped to make our country a cleaner and beautiful place.
Yay.
It is true. You know, we are known around the world, for instance, for like our national park system, and some of our natural resources have made us the strong and productive country that we are today. We are truly blessed.
We are. Yeah, you go. It's not every country that you can go to where you have clean drinkable water and clean breathable air. I mean, we've been experiencing a little bit with all of this smoke the past few weeks, but yeah, that's some people live their whole lives that way. So,
well, you look at it, you know,
for the water.
Yeah, we talked about the masks last week or the week before, and think about that. The people in China, they're wearing those masks all the time, but not here in the States.
No, typically we have an incredible air quality, especially in the upstate of South Carolina and in the southeastern region compared to a lot of places.
Yeah.
Lot of times we will take that for granted. So when we have instances, when we have natural disasters like wildfires or something that does impact our air quality, it does kind of jump out and get people's attention.
It does. And that, you know, that's sometimes what it has to take, is just an event so big that it jumps out and get people's attention. For instance, there is a river in Ohio called the Cuyahoga River. And back in the day, picture, if you will, let's go back all the way to the 1800s, 1868, this river catches on fire. And it catches on fire again 13 times between 1868 and 1969. So 101 years, 13 fires.
So what was this river made out of then that it was catching on fire?
Well, the river itself was made of water, but the river was also a dumping ground for industrial waste. The river was so full of pollution that it caught on fire over and over and over and over. And
right.
Over.
Bad.
Can I say that 13 times?
So, were people getting their drinking water from the source?
That I don't know.
It's likely. If you notice, a lot of our major cities in the United States and in the Southeast are built alongside rivers, just like Greenville, South Carolina, is built alongside the Reedy River. Asheville is built alongside the Broad River. Columbia, also on the Broad River. And so, you know, a lot of townships and villages started out along the riverside. So it kind of makes sense that they're going to be impacted as we grow and develop.
Oh, yeah,
society.
Especially with all the mills along the river and just all the industry that used the river. But luckily, this burning river helped to spur a series of environmental pollution controls, and this is where we got the Clean Water Act from. And the creation of the EPA, along with the Ohio EPA and a lot of statewide EPAs and smaller county-level organizations. So it's a good thing. And so it was first called the Federal Water Pollution Control Act in 1948, and it was the first major U.S. law to address water pollution. All of these rivers kept burning in Ohio, and eventually it was amended in 1972 and became known as what we call today the Clean Water Act. And it basically just established a basic structure for regulating pollutant discharges into the waters of the U.S. So this is the first time that factories had limits on what and how much they could dump into the water.
Which is a good thing.
It is. It started a whole permitting process. So now you have to have permits and you can only dump certain types of things and X amount of things, and it has to be cleared by all the higher ups. So I think an outdated look at water pollution, if you ask somebody, well, what's polluting our water? Oh, factories are just dumping. And, you know, that's at one point that was current. But now our bigger issue is non-point source pollution, like those dog poops, those oils, the things that you can't just point to the factory and say, ah, that's where the pollution's coming from. Let's stop it.
And right. When it does come from a factory, which it has even recently, they found For those of you who remember in the not too distant past, it was in the past year, I believe, when Lake Conestee turned bright, crazy lime, chartreuse, greenish yellow. It was terrible.
Not an attractive watercolor.
No, but in that case, it was traced back to an industrial use, but schmack. They had to clean it up and there were fines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that we do have protections out there to make sure that our surface waters, at the very least, are kept pollutant-free, because I sure do enjoy recreating in them. I enjoy fishing off our dock on Lake Hartwell, and I certainly enjoy a nice cold glass of clean water from the tap. So we don't need to take those things for granted. But in addition to our water, is there anything that we need to do to protect our air?
Well, there certainly is. We had the Clean Air Act passed shortly after the Clean Water Act was passed. And this was passed in, it first came around about the 1950s. 1955 was when the idea first was proposed, but it wasn't until 1970. And then again in 77 and 1990 that it keeps getting updated to address more and more standards. So,
right. And it's important, especially in this day and age, that we sort of are able to revisit these things and understand, you know, we want to continue growing our economy and we want to continue being a prosperous society. But at the same time, we have to balance that with sustainable environmental practices, because if we don't have water and air, it's kind of a moot point if we're going to have any jobs, if we can't live here and breathe.
Can't do anything without water and air.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So I like the fact that we revisit these and based on solid scientific-based research, make sound policy decisions.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we just have to keep updating and advancing. And it's amazing what's in the air to me. I mean, you know, this week with the fires, we've kind of gotten a glimpse of what's all in the air, but all this particulate matter, all this ozone, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, right, carbon monoxide, lead. These are the things, by the way, the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act is regulating for, in case you were wondering.
And
I was.
Do you know what it used to be, though, in the 60s and 70s? It was the vapors of Aquanet.
The hairspray. Because there were lots of it.
Clean Air Act regulated right, the hydrofluorocarbons that propelled hairspray. So now we have natural looking hair. And that also, not a bad thing.
Right. Although those beehives really had some, they were impressive.
So the Clean Air Act really changed the fashion of the 1980s.
Absolutely. What's really interesting, what influences these policy decisions? So you mentioned the historical instances of rivers catching on fire. We talked about, you know, society's extreme use of propellants in aerosol cans when that technology came out. And then we can even move forward to, like, with the Wildlife Act in the 1969. And a lot of this, again, goes all the way back to the turn of the century when we talk about Theodore Roosevelt. You know, he was such a huge proponent of preserving our wilderness and our things that are unique to the United States of America, like, for instance, our national parks. I mean, we have an incredible abundance of natural resources in this country, which is one of the things that makes us so prosperous and so great. And so to protect those early on was really forward thinking. And I know, talking to my dad, who's a great conservation and he's a hunter as well. He's part of Trout Unlimited and Quality Deer Management. So these are all organizations based on recreational use and actually protecting these resources so that we continue to hunt and recreate and to fish and to enjoy these wild places. And that had to start somewhere. And so, you know, when we start to realize that we're running out of these things or that we're damaging these things, that influences that policy. And it's really important.
It does. Yeah. Well, stay tuned. After the break, we're going to talk about some of the fundamentals, the history of wildlife policy and where it's brought us today. You're tuned in to the Saturday Splash on 94.5 WGTK, The Answer. Bank, quarry, river swim, rainy skin day.